Daniel and chapter 5. We won't read the whole of it. I will only read verse 1 to verse 12. Daniel chapter 1, chapter 5, verse 1 to verse 12. If you are there, we commence reading. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you, or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Well, brethren, let's end our reading there. As I keep saying, we are deliberately going through the book of Daniel, beginning last year in January, because there are lessons in this book that especially young people need to grasp and consequently live by. They need to grasp them in order for them to reach levels of earthly greatness without destroying themselves. And it is a common reality that a lot of individuals, and I'm thinking here about professing Christians, and not all of them are professing, but not many of them are genuine Christians, when they begin to smell the air that is up there, as it were, they come unstuck. They end up with a religion that is barely managing to cover over their nakedness, as it were. But there is nothing on the inside. That fighting power that they once had as young people is completely lost. They are nothing but a resounding gong. And those who knew them in their earlier days just feel sorry for them. And brethren, this shouldn't happen to you. There is such great potential in the numbers of young people that are coming here that you need to be inoculated, vaccinated against whatever this bacteria is that is leaving so many people a shadow of themselves. And in this book of Daniel, we learn not so much about Daniel, as important as that might be, but about God, about your God, and about the fact that your God is sovereign, your God is faithful. And in the recent past, it's very clear that this sovereignty of God is being trumpeted into our ears as we are looking at these chapters of Daniel. We were seeing Nebuchadnezzar for the last few weeks, and in the last encounter that we had with him, Nebuchadnezzar learned the sovereignty of God the hard way. He had seen a vision in the night, called in, as usual, the interpreters who couldn't help, brought in Daniel, who genuinely, sincerely told him the truth. Pride was coming into your heart. Your downfall would soon follow. He never listened. And one day, walking on his palace, looking at what he had achieved, pride did enter into his heart, and the fall came. He came crashing down, reduced to an animal, almost an animal, on all fours, with his hair grown like feathers, as he was having to eat grass, as though he was an animal, with the dew falling upon him and consequently making him wet, until finally, with his back against the wall, he lifted up his eyes to heaven, acknowledged who God is, and God in grace restored him, not only to his former position, but even higher than that. That's what we saw with respect to Nebuchadnezzar. And we made the appeal, I hope you were here, that let's learn above all the other lessons in life that God is God. God is supreme. God is sovereign. God has a right to do with our lives as he pleases. Absolutely. He gives, he takes away. He is God. And only when we learn who God is in that way will we stop asking the question, God, why? Oh God, why me? As if we've got a right to question God, as if we've got a right to question God about what he sends our way or what he keeps away from us. He has that right. And oh, that we may learn it speedily while we are still young. Today, we start another character. And he is mentioned in the very first verse of chapter 5. And that is Belshazzar. We learn about him in chapter 5, chapter 6, chapter 7, and chapter 8. So we've got quite a few chapters around this man's life. And he is referred to as the son of Nebuchadnezzar, but as we shall see in a few moments, there's quite a lot around that title. And the lesson that we are continuing to learn as we come to this individual is precisely the same as we learned the previous chapter. God is sovereign. Don't play games with him. As we were hearing in our Bible reading a few minutes ago, we must be those who tremble at his word. We must be those who have a genuine fear, a holy fear for this God, without playing games with him. Because as we shall see here, he can do anything. He can do anything. It doesn't matter how high you have reached. God, at the click of his finger, can bring everything crumbling down. He is sovereign. Now you might be asking the question, but we've already learned this in chapter 4. In fact, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4. So why again in chapter 5? It's precisely for the same reason that the lesson that the previous generation learned, this generation also needs to learn. There's nothing like what our father was taught now has become ours automatically. Never. Hence you sometimes find, in fact in a lot of cases you find, that whereas somebody's parents may have been truly godly, truly godly, the children have godliness as simply a thin covering over a life of selfishness, self-centeredness, and sin. In other words, they themselves need to learn that God is sovereign. It's not a lesson that is passed on down to us simply through blood relations. It is a lesson we need to learn as individuals before God. That the God who rules this universe does not owe me anything. Instead, I owe him all. So my question is, not so much how godly are your parents and what is your spiritual background that should make us not be surprised about where you are and who you are. Rather the question is, have you learned that God is sovereign? Have you learned that his dominion is an everlasting dominion? His kingdom endures from generation to generation, that all the inhabitants, and that includes you, all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will. Among the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say to him, what have you done? Have you learned that? Not as a family. Have you learned that as an individual? Is that the burner upon which your spiritual life is molded? That the one that I worship is the sovereign God of the universe. He does as he pleases. He will do with me as he pleases, and one day I will stand before him to give an account to him for my life. Well, what's the first lesson that we are learning then from Belshazzar? I've entitled it, The Price of Pride. The Price of Pride. What we learn first in this chapter are the occasions that often cause us to be guilty of the sin of pride. To be guilty of the sin of pride. For Belshazzar, the height of this sin came on the occasion of drinking a lot of wine. This one tells us King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Now, a few words there for us to appreciate. And the best way to do so is to try and understand who Belshazzar is. Who was he? Now, in this chapter, a number of times he's referred to as the son of Nebuchadnezzar. In verse 2, for instance, we read the phrase, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought. We find exactly the same words in his wife, the queen, down in verse 11. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians. And in a sense, we would conclude that he must have been an immediate son of Nebuchadnezzar. History seems to suggest that, in fact, the one who took over from Nebuchadnezzar was a gentleman called Nabonidas. Nabonidas. Nabonidus. And I tried to remember it by following the guy who came to meet Jesus by night, Nicodemus. Apart from the consonants, the vowels are exactly the same. Alright, Nabonidus. He's the one who took over from Nebuchadnezzar and reigned for a number of years. In fact, the period that is referred to when Daniel lived, it was this gentleman who was ruling. And, you know, Babylon was not like Mono Motapa somewhere in Africa, where probably you don't even have the history recorded. Babylon's history is in black and white, and consequently it is there without argument. So scholars have often wrestled over this matter. Who was Belshazzar? Thankfully, it has come to the attention of scholars that yes, there was a Belshazzar in the period of Babylon himself, and he was the son of Nabonidus. He was the son of Nabonidus. So in which sense then is he a son of Nebuchadnezzar? What has since come to be learned was that while Nabonidus was king of Babylon, while he was extending his empire, he then moved his palace, his headquarters, out of the immediate area that was called Babylon. And then he got his son to be there as his regent. And therefore, the place where the Israelites had been taken in captivity, the one at that time who was ruling there was Belshazzar. And hence, them referring to him here as king. He was not the overall king of the empire. He was king in terms of the one who has been left to rule by his father, who had since moved his headquarters elsewhere. Now, all that is not in your Bibles, but if you do go back home and you are young, which I trust most of you are here, do a bit of Googling, which your parents don't know, but that's okay. They're not the ones I'm addressing. Do a bit of Googling and see for yourself all this history. There are thoughts that perhaps Nabonidus married one of, or a number of, the concubines of Nebuchadnezzar, and consequently one of those children became therefore an heir as well, and that would have been Belshazzar. But those are theories that cannot be proven. What I've given to you is that which at least has been proven. And the only reason why they are going into marrying the concubine and so on is because of this phrase over and over again, your father, your father, your father. But again, you all know in the Bible that your father does not necessarily mean your actual direct father, just as Jesus is often referred to as the son of David. And yet we know that there are quite a number of people in between, and often it simply means that someone who is in that line of ancestry. Okay, so this was Belshazzar. And so even in referring to him as king, and this is the point I'm trying to make us to understand, that it was not really his position by way of right. It was his position by way of privilege. Privilege had come to him. And consequently, he was being referred to as king. And often, that's the problem with us. Often, when a person has really worked and toiled to make his way up, there is a certain humility individuals have. When you've toiled for your wealth, there's a sense in which it usually doesn't get there too quickly. But when it has been bequeathed to you, when you've simply inherited it, when it's come to you as a privilege on a silver plate, often that's when it gets to our heads. Often that's when we really fail. And that's what we are finding here. Belshazzar was not really the king, but clearly he wanted to show he was king. There are a few hints in this chapter that suggests that he was not the top man. And the hint is found in the award or reward that he was promising whoever would finally bring him the answer. And it's always that person would be third in the kingdom. Let's just quickly see that. In verse 7, the king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and here it is, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Or, verse 16, but I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you shall be third ruler in the kingdom. Or, as we read in verse 29, then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, and a chain of gold was put around his neck, And a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Why not the second? Well, because Belshazzar himself is the second. There's someone else who's on top of him. And that is what Nabonidus was. Very well then, with a little bit of that history, let's then say the man threw a party. He threw a party, and in due season he got drunk. And it is out of this drunkenness that he ended up doing what he ought not to have done. And it's very clear in the way it is phrased that although the other people were there, they did not have as much wine as he himself had. Look at the verse. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords. And then he says, and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Clearly, he must have had the king's size bottle, so to speak. So that the thousands were envying him as he was guzzling in the wine compared to what they had. Of course he was making the point. I'm the king. You may be lords, you may be rulers, you may be whatever, but I'm that king here. And that ought to be very evident. Now brethren, I have already said there was one cause. And it's a danger we all have to be mindful of. And it is getting into positions that we haven't risen up for. The problem is we now want everybody to know, and consequently it gets to our heads. The second is strong drink, alcohol. Now in Western countries it's often argued as debatable whether Christians should drink or not. I think here where we are, it's not debatable. And any Christians who drink do it secretly. But it soon becomes evident with their red eyes. This can't be a result of using candles during Zesco blackouts. What does Proverbs 31 say to us? Proverbs 31. It warns us of two dangers. Women and wine. Women and wine. Proverbs 31 and verse 3. Do not give your strength to women, your ways to those who destroy kings. There it is. Who destroy kings. And then the next. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to take strong drink, lest they drink and forget what has been decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to the one who is perishing, and wine to those in bitter distress. Let them drink and forget their poverty and remember their misery no more. Brethren, the point there is pretty obvious. First of all, what brought down Samson? Women. What has brought down so many pastors in the world? Women. Real leaders brought down that way. If there is anything, I'm speaking to you as young people, and I'm speaking to you both males and females, that the potential for downfall in your sexuality is high. And I mean it. It's high. You be careless in that area, you may survive excommunication because you managed to cover over it, but I want to assure you that it's going to dog you for the rest of your life. Aim for purity in that area. I plead with you. 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now, whether all you are going to be is a shadow of your own self, warming a pew, or whether you are going to be dynamite for the Lord Jesus Christ, is largely going to depend on the way in which you guard yourself in that area. The wise man is saying it here. But he's not only stopping there, he's also coming to the issue of drink. And I am not taking it for granted that young Reformed Baptists don't drink. Just because they don't play around beer halls. And therefore, it is an appeal that I'm making from the depth of my heart. You play with that brown bottle, you are gone. I'm telling you, you are gone. Under the power of strong drink, many young people have destroyed themselves. Take that route if you want. But I want to assure you that that becomes the downfall of many. And I say it with bitterness in my own soul. Because after my own mom died, I became an adopted child. The home I went into already had 4 sons. They are all dead. All of them. Alcohol played a major part of it. Gone! And if you're sitting here thinking, not me, not me, not me, I'm saying close your Bible. Because here are the words of the wise man making it clear. That's not the way to go. Leave it to the tramp who goes to pick things in garbage pits. Leave it to him so that as he drinks and picks the garbage and puts it in front of himself, he may be thinking he's a king. And if you know of a young person who professes the name of the Lord and is playing with alcohol, I'm saying plead with your friend until tears come out of your eyes. Let your friend know that this is not the way to go, that alcohol is not going to make him into a man of God. Never, never, 1,000 times never. And that's very clear. Not only from the book of Proverbs, but that's what happened to King Belshazzar. The Bible is very clear that what we're about to read was because of the alcohol he drank. Look at verse 2. The Bible says there, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought them in, the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem. And the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood and stone. Why all this? They were drunk. Why all this? They were drunk. And especially Belshazzar himself, when he tasted the wine. It's giddy enough being up there and so many people looking up to you. It's giddy enough. Throw in wine, it only makes it worse. It does. I sometimes am tempted to find out who the owners of the bars along Chilimburu Road are. And I'd like to find out from them the names of their clients 10 years ago. And I'd also want to give them the names of my clients 20 years ago. And then say, let me look for your clients, look for mine. And let's compare notes after a month. I'm almost sure that as I look for those clients, I'll find them in Leopards Hill Cemetery. And that all the clients they now have are new people. And one way in which you can tell is go there and look at the average age. Go there. One of the reasons why is pretty simple. The prostitutes are standing outside the bar. That's where they are. I'm often going home quite late in the evening because of coming from visitation. Even last night I was going home around 21 hours. And as you are driving, each time you pass by a bar, you see young ladies dressed, or better still, undressed like this. I think that's not really dressing, it's more of undressing. Waiting outside. What are they waiting for? Well, I'll tell you. The man who went in with his brain intact while he's drinking, that brain gets eroded. He comes out of that place, he's seeing strange women as bedmates. The prostitutes know that. Just in case you didn't know. Let them try and do it every Sunday evening after the evening service outside Kabwata Baptist Church. Okay, you got the message. In fact, even if you came in here, it'll get you. You go out sober, isn't it? After the sermon. Eh? Then the sight of a prostitute, you're already looking up to heaven. Lord, when are you coming back? Look, the message is clear. Strong drink short circuits your thinking process. And even if you had morals to begin with, they go down the drain. And before long you sleep around with prostitutes, and before long we are burying you. Or burying your relatives. For all the wrong reasons. Well, this guy got drunk. And he dared God. The more he drank, the more boisterous he was becoming. The more noisy. The more daring. And that's what the strong drink does. You're driving home at night. And you see individuals going right into the middle of the road with a beer bottle. Hey, get out, you get out. The temptation is to put the car into gear, fight, and press the accelerator. Let's see what will happen to him. But they're as bold as a lion. That's what happened. It causes you to push boundaries that you ought not to push. Stories told of a gentleman who used to drink a lot. On one occasion, he's in the village, he was making his way back to the village, and he came across a lion. And he commanded that lion to get out of his way. warned it that if I find you here again, you will live to regret it. And sure enough, the lion went into the bush. And the people that were afraid for him could not believe it. The story ends that the following morning they told him what happened. He collapsed and died. But friends, the story, the point is still being made. This daringness that comes to you, that makes you do what in your normal mind you dare not do. There's a level of fear, there's a level of respect that you throw away, you throw caution to the wind, and you just go for it. That's what we find. That's what we find. And there's a saying, I don't know how many languages have it, but at least the Bembas have it, Atleka Njemunwina. Simply means, let me go and drink, then I'll come back and sort him out. Let me go and drink first, then I'll come back and sort him out. There will be a courage I will have once I've guzzled in a few bottles, which I don't have right now. So let me go and drink first. And sadly, Belshazzar, in his being daring, he now even dared God. That's what he did. He dared God. He got all these vessels from the temple, golden vessels, come and bring them here and let's drink. And obviously, still feeling, these are the heights I have reached, this issue of God, what can he do to me, and so on. And at that point, he crossed the line. And so many individuals, upon reaching heights of success, the brain gets giddy and they begin to use and abuse the church, the people of God. They've done it out there and then they bring it in here. And at that point, God says, enough is enough. And that's what he did here. Even in the darkest moment, when from visibility, God has been utterly defeated, he is sovereign. He can still assert his greatness overall. And that's what happened here. I mean, the last thing Belshazzar would have expected, the last thing, was that he would become insecure at that point. The last thing. How? His father was ruling over the entire kingdom. He was ruling over the immediate Babylon. His were but slaves around him and his own people. They are not the ones who elected him. He got his power from his father and his grandfather, etc., etc. Here he is now celebrating in his palace. What on earth can touch me? God can. And so we read of this finger of a human hand that suddenly appeared, wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, opposite the lampstand. The king saw the hand as it wrote, and the king's color changed. That's how it is. There's one thing we must never forget. He is immortal. We are not. He has all power and authority. We don't. And even when men and women have sung our praises, let it not get to our heads. Because at the click of a finger, our entire little kingdom can come crumbling down. And God has a thousand ways in which to do so. Ways which, when there is godliness, we can handle the situation. If you were a godly lord or ruler and brought or governed and brought into this world party, and everybody's drinking their heads off and shouting everything that comes to their minds and so on, I'm sure your own soul would be distraught by what you are seeing and hearing. And consequently, as the hand begins to write, yes, terror would be upon everybody else. Yes, there would be a level of terror in your own heart. But you would have a stability and a solidity because you know that only God could do this, and you are this child. You've not wanted to be a part of this mindless, righteous kind of living. It makes a world of a difference. And that's what happens in life. A person who's thrown God out of their lives, and they think, now I have it made, and it's all women and wine and fame and everything else. The moment God touches their health, bang, or the health of a loved one, or the moment God takes away a loved one through betrayal, through whatever else it might be, the moment they are overthrown from their position, again through the malice of other people, their entire lives come crumbling down. Come crumbling down. First of all, they can't believe it. They are a sorry sight, because God was not there. God was not there. He was not their foundation. He was not the one they trusted in. They were not walking with the living God. So when he pulls them down, they go past the zero bench and go right down into the dregs. Some of them even commit suicide in the process. So the lesson we're learning here is God is sovereign. You will never be too high for God to fail to reach up to you and bring you down. Never. Beware of it. Beware. Now friends, I know you are young. And as I said this, you're probably sitting there thinking, come on. Not me. Others, yeah. Not me. All I'm saying is, go to those who've lived a little longer than you and ask them. Ask them who the idols of their days were. Who the big names were. Ask them who the big political figures were. Who the big soccer stars were. Who used to claim openly that God doesn't exist. Come on, doesn't. Ask them. And then do what I said earlier. Google their names. And find out what happened. You discover, it's a sad, sad story. Even in political circles, it's not a sad. Find out who the great names were. And you soon see, you don't play with God. You don't. There is a price that is paid for pride. We are told at the very end of this story, well, at least verse 9, where we are ending tonight, then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. That's where the story ends. His lords were perplexed. And I want us to end there for tonight. Because sadly, unless men and women come to genuine repentance, that's where they end. A miserable, miserable lot. And those who were around them and were singing, "He's a jolly good fellow, cha-chawe," and everything else, now they are also there, helplessly watching, unable to make out how this could have happened. It is God. It is God. It is God. He is sovereign. He has the right to do with our lives as He pleases. Human greatness easily ends up in the dust. Easily does. That's what we find here. And oh brethren, that all of us may have this godly fear so that we don't play with God. Our agenda must never be us and our greatness. It must never be. Our agenda should ever be God, God's glory, God's honor. And even if He causes me to rise and rise and rise and brings me to the highest station, even there I will recognize this is about God. He wants me to serve Him here. He has honored me by bringing me this far above my fellow, that I may use my privileges for His honor, for His glory. This is about God. And soon, very soon, He'll take me out of this life. And when I appear before Him, may I say to Him, "Lord, my life was all about you. All about you." And even when you denied me any privilege that others may have, I was saying, "Not my will, but yours be done." You have been sovereign, and you will ever be sovereign. Shouldn't we be confessing, brethren, as we shall be singing in a few moments, that we haven't really known God His way? That there's still so much of ourselves, so much of ourselves in it. We've not really learned His wisdom, His grace, His power. The things of earth have filled our thoughts, and the trifles, the emptiness, the vanities of the passing hour. Lord, give us light, Thy truth to see, and make us wise in knowing. May God do that for us. Especially young people, I plead with you. Know this kind of God, and the sky will be the limit for you. You will be the kind of adults this nation desperately needs. Desperately needs. Only as you get to know this God.